Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you.
Brexit.
The ayes to the right, 358. The noes to the left, 234.
It's official, but Brexit is never really done until it's done. Also, Nigerians, it turns out, kind of love Donald Trump.
People tend to agree he's not the nicest person, he's not the most righteous human being or anything, but they believe that he's an instrument in God's hands to push God's agenda in this time.
And 30 years ago, Romania's dictator was ousted and executed. We hear from the man who delivered swift justice.
General Stanculescu told us that the Ceausescu couple is there and that they will be tried and executed. We knew before the trial that we have to execute them.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. He promised to get Brexit done. And today, the British Prime Minister took a significant step in that direction. Boris Johnson got his Brexit deal passed in Parliament, and the vote wasn't even close. This puts the UK on track to finally leave the European Union by the end of next month. But Britain has been part of the EU for 45 years. That means getting Brexit done, for real, is going to take some more time, as The World's Orla Barry reports from London.
The outcome was clear. Boris Johnson was on the cusp of victory, finally, on Brexit. When he introduced his withdrawal bill to Parliament today, Johnson evoked Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
This is the time when we move on and discard the old labels of leave and remain. In fact, the very words seem tired to me as I speak, as defunct as big enders and little enders, or Montagues and Capulets at the end of the play. Now is the time to act together as one reinvigorated nation, one united kingdom.
But there was no such call for unity from the opposition benches. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, said that Johnson's Brexit deal would be bad for manufacturing, for trade relations and for the environment. Britain, he said, would begin a race with America to the bottom, a race with ugly consequences for critical issues like food quality.
So the choice we now face is between keeping the highest environmental and food standards in order to get a future trade deal with the European Union, or slashing food standards to match those of the United States, where there are so-called acceptable levels of rat hairs in paprika, maggots in orange juice. It's true.
The back and forth continued throughout the day. This bill is somewhat different from the one Johnson tried and failed to get through Parliament only a couple of months ago. There's no possibility of extending negotiations with the EU beyond the end of next year. Some say this is a tactic by Johnson to show voters and European leaders that he means business. Others fear it hands all the negotiating cards over to Europe. Opposition politicians like Labour's Hilary Benn worry it could all end up in a no-deal Brexit scenario.
The negotiations are anything but simple. They become extremely complicated. And that's why I said that I thought the government is taking a big gamble with the future of the economy. Because if they don't achieve this deal by December next year, then we're looking once again at no deal.
The new bill also drops a promise to align workers' rights with EU laws, and it abandons a vow to protect child refugees seeking to unite with their families in Britain. Lord Dubs, another Labour politician who himself arrived in the UK as a young boy fleeing from Nazi Germany, says the change could be devastating for child migrants in Europe.
And these are children who are sleeping in difficult, dangerous conditions in Calais or on the Greek islands, particularly on Lesbos. They are children who are vulnerable. They're vulnerable to trafficking. They're vulnerable to criminality, to prostitution and so on. And they've got family here. And they've set their sights on joining a member of their family who's in the UK. Surely what is more sensible and humane than that?
Scottish MPs are unhappy too. Ian Blackford is one of the leaders of the Scottish National Party. He says Johnson's Brexit deal will be harmful to Scotland.
The Prime Minister is blindly hurtling towards the cliff edge with these deeply damaging Brexit plans that will leave us poorer, that will leave us worse off. This legislation will hit our economy, cost thousands of jobs in Scotland, sell out our food and drink sector, and harm people's livelihoods.
But for all the fire and fury from the opposition, the Prime Minister had little to worry about.
The ayes to the right, 358. The noes to the left, 234.
And so Johnson's Brexit deal was passed with a whopping majority of 124 votes. As MPs head home for Christmas, though, they know this is just phase one. There'll be more Brexit votes to come and many more debates ahead in the new year, because actually extricating itself from the EU will take the British government some time. There's also still the question of the Irish border and the long-held dreams of independence in Scotland. For Boris Johnson, these next 12 months could be the toughest negotiations of his career by far. So, to put it in Shakespearean terms, the winter of his discontent might finally be coming to an end. But the Prime Minister might do well to remember how badly things turn out for so many of Shakespeare's protagonists. After all, some of the writer's most enduring plays are tragedies. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
De Hoge Raad komt nu tot het oordeel.
Another big decision, years in the making, took place in the Netherlands today.
Moet worden verworpen.
The Dutch Supreme Court ruled that the government there must cut greenhouse gas emissions to protect the human rights of its citizens. Dennis van Berkel was in the front row of the courtroom cheering himself. Van Berkel was one of the lawyers on the case.
That was a huge feeling of relief, of joy and of hope, because this is the first time that there is a recognition by a highest court that countries have legal obligations to reduce their emissions.
The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, spoke with him, and she's here with me in the studio. Carolyn, how big of a deal is this?
Carol, this is significant because it is a first, just like van Berkel outlined. The ruling is going to force the Netherlands to cut its own greenhouse gas emissions faster than it otherwise would. But it's also likely to be cited in cases potentially across Europe as legal precedent. This case was brought by an environmental foundation called Urgenda on behalf of nearly 900 Dutch citizens, and its lawyer, Dennis van Berkel, says he actually hopes it does more than set precedent, but actually force other governments into cutting carbon emissions before they can be sued.
What courts can do is they can look at the facts and they can say, well, here the government really crossed the line. And what we really want is for governments not to cross that line and to take up their responsibility and to start acting in the interest of the people.
So what did the ruling actually say? I mean, what does it mean for the Netherlands?
The court upheld previous verdicts that the Netherlands needs to cut its greenhouse gas emissions, its carbon emissions, by 25% from 1990 levels by the end of 2020. So that's next year. The Dutch government has said it will strive to meet this target, just like it did when this case was originally filed. It is not, though, quite on target to meet that target. So it is going to have to come up with some new carbon cutting strategies to try to get there by the end of next year.
So how far off are they?
As of last year, the country had cut its emissions by about 15%. Right now, it's looking like it's on target to reduce emissions somewhere around 20% by the end of next year. And some environmental groups, including Urgenda, who brought this case, have outlined a number of ways that it might be able to get to that target, from shutting down some new coal-fired power plants to increasing energy efficiency across the country.
You mentioned this could have a wider impact than just in the Netherlands. What might that be?
Well, it actually already has had a pretty big impact. It's inspired similar cases around the world, none of which have been as successful as this one. But going forward, former judge and Council on Foreign Relations climate policy expert Alice Hill says it does set an important legal precedent.
This is an important decision, and I think it could drive or influence decisions elsewhere. I am confident it will be widely cited by those who are seeking a similar type of judgment.
And that's because this ruling is based in part, at least, on the Dutch government's obligation under the European Convention on Human Rights. So this could be a precedent for any of the almost 50 other countries that are signed on to this convention.
And what about in the U.S.?
This ruling is not likely to have an impact here in the States. International court cases don't really play into the way judges see law here in the States. But there is a somewhat analogous case that's winding its way through the courts right now. It's called Juliana versus the U.S. It was filed on behalf of 21 young people who say that the federal government's actions contributing to climate change have violated their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. That case right now is stuck in appeals court. But if and when it does make its way to the Supreme Court, it could be the kind of precedent-setting decision here in the States that we just had from the Dutch High Court.
The World's Carolyn Baylor. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
One of the world's oldest nuclear power plants was switched off today. Switzerland's Mühleberg power plant was first opened in 1972. For decades, though, there have been questions about its safety. But Swiss policies to phase out nuclear power and replace it with renewable energy sources like wind and solar, well, the old nuclear reactor is finally being taken off the grid. The BBC's Imogene Folks has our story from the Swiss capital of Bern, not far from the power plant.
For many Swiss, especially those in and around the capital Bern, it's become a countdown. 2 weeks to go, 1 week to go. Now the day is here. Mühleberg power station is finally shutting down after 47 years in service. Demands for its closure have lasted almost as long. They became impossible to ignore after the 2011 Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan. This is what Geneva politician Pierre Vanik told me then.
We are very much opposed to nuclear power, and naturally this major accident or series of accidents in Japan brings us to oppose the building of new nuclear reactors in Switzerland, but also to ask that the oldest reactors be closed, in particular the reactor in Mühleberg, the oldest Swiss reactor in the canton of Bern, which is the same type basically as the Fukushima reactors.
Mühleberg has had its own safety issues, and that's why everyone within a 50-kilometre radius gets iodine tablets in case of radiation poisoning. And here they are in my own bathroom cabinet, four boxes, one for each member of the family, to be taken, it says here, only on the instructions of the authorities. It's not exactly reassuring.
Wir werden mit diesem Szenario.
That's why so many Swiss were relieved when the energy minister, Doris Leuthard, announced a radical change in policy. No more nuclear power.
Die bestehenden Reaktoren.
The existing reactors will keep on going for as long as they're safe. We estimate each has a lifespan from coming on stream of about 50 years. So the last one will be closed in 2034.
Im Raum von 2034.
Switzerland gets 40% of its power from nuclear energy. And in the years since that announcement, things have had to change. The focus is on renewables. And here on my own street, the roofs on the houses all used to be tiled, but now, every month or so, it seems someone is installing solar panels. Meanwhile, over at Mühleberg, the decommissioning is well underway. Parties and concerts will accompany the big switch-off, but one man will be watching with sadness. Hans Rudolf Lutz, Mühleberg's very first director.
Our Swiss nuclear power stations, they were among the world's first, the start of the nuclear era. So Mühleberg, it was really like my baby. And when it goes, part of me goes as well.
And so from today, no more power will come from Mühleberg. The radioactive core will be gradually removed, the vast concrete walls bulldozed, and by 2034, this site should be a quiet Swiss green pasture again.
The BBC's Imogene Folks there. And here's another one for your date book. Starting tomorrow in New Zealand, it will be illegal to possess military-style semi-automatic firearms. You may recall that in March this year, a gunman armed with just such a weapon opened fire at a mosque in the city of Christchurch. The attack killed 51 people. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern promised swift action.
I can tell you one thing right now. Our gun laws will change.
And change they have. Tens of thousands of guns have already been handed over to police, with many gun owners, like this man in Christchurch, happy to oblige.
Oh, yeah, I have no problem handing it in. Yeah, no problem at all.
I have a it's a pump action shotgun, and I just use it for clay bird shooting and duck shooting. That's it.
But some gun owners feel they're being victimized for the actions of one man.
They're not weapons, they're rifles, firearms. I don't do weapons. I feel put upon, really.
The gun debate, New Zealand style. You're with The World.
As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 1989 was a year of revolution. Protests brought down communist regimes in Poland, East Germany, and what was then Czechoslovakia. They were mostly peaceful, but in Romania, things were different. Their revolution was bloody. That December, more than 1,000 people were killed. Romania's dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, gave his last speech 30 years ago tomorrow. And on Christmas Day, he and his wife were tried and executed.
Ceausescu moved his hands in a show of resignation. And that was it. The end of a 24-year Romanian nightmare.
The BBC's Tessa Dunlop recently traveled to Romania to see how the revolution has shaped the country. Tessa, set the scene for us. What triggered the protests 30 years ago?
It's really no coincidence that the revolution began in Timișoara, which is the most westerly city in Romania, very exposed in a clandestine way to international media, so aware of what was happening across the borders. And what happens is a touch paper, if you like, what starts as this niche sitting over a Hungarian priest quickly snowballs into something bigger that involves pretty much the whole city. And the extraordinary violent response of the regime is to open fire, so to arm up against its own people, tanks, guns, out on the streets, 78 shot dead there and then.
You spoke with someone who was there. Here's Soren Opera, who was a factory worker at the time.
I was scared, of course. They point the guns to me and they start shooting. So two friends of mine, they die near to me. I mean, a couple of friends of mine, yeah. But I was shot just in my leg. So I managed to escape.
What were those protests like on the ground in Timișoara?
Terrifying. People dying. I know of a story of in that square, a bullet penetrated the wall of an apartment and shot dead the only child of a couple, the six-year-old daughter of a couple who never recovered from that. So there was collateral damage as well, of course, as the people protesting on the streets. It was absolutely horrific.
So Ceausescu responds in some respects to the protests in Timișoara by trying to recreate a kind of triumphant speech to crowds in Bucharest. But that kind of goes badly too, doesn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing backfires. He sort of tells them he's going to give them extra money and stuff, and it doesn't work. I mean, Ceausescu has bust his country in this kind of crazy economic model. He splits from the Soviets, so he's unable to properly feed the population. They're queuing for bread. They're queuing for disgusting-tasting coffee. Romanian nationalism and the Soviet model didn't work, you know. So when he tries to sort of throw them a line about, you know, giving them better pay or whatever, it doesn't wash. People are like, no, we've had this.
But then on Christmas Day, things kind of take a different turn. Ceausescu and his wife, Elena, they're tried and executed. And you set up this pretty incredible scene in the documentary where you talk to the person who is known in Romania as the man who killed Ceausescu. Here's Eunel Boiaru.
General Stanculescu told us that the Ceausescu couple is there and that they will be tried and executed. We knew before the trial that we have to execute them.
So you knew before the trial that you would be the man that shot Ceausescu?
Yes, I knew. General Stanculescu told us how to execute them, how many bullets to shoot, from what position and from what distance. He told us to fire from the hip up. General Stanculescu told me that if I heard anything going on outside the room, then I should immediately shoot the Ceausescu couple, regardless of any collateral damage inside the trial room.
Now, tell us about Boyeru.
He was a paratrooper. He's got big, broad shoulders. You can see the stamp of a soldier on him. But he was carrying out orders. What's interesting about that story, aside from, you know, the mind of an assassin and how you manage that, and it would seem that he's kind of come to terms with it. What's interesting is that from the 23rd, when Ceausescu flees and his execution, the shootings on the streets of Bucharest increase. Over 800 people die in that period. Now, it's not Ceausescu shooting them. What's happening there is the new power, the National Salvation Front, is consolidating its own rule. And they do that through this spread of fear, chaos, you know, the Ceausescu's terrorists. And those are the deaths where justice has not been done. To this day, men and women still do not understand why their loved ones were shot dead when Ceausescu had been toppled.
So 30 years on, what politically has really changed in Romania?
What you have born from these sort of terrible, unaccountable, punitive acts is a culture of activism, a kind of culture of going out on the streets and saying, this ain't good enough. And Romanians have consistently done that for the last 30 years. And of course, they've been hugely emboldened by coming into the EU in 2007 and freedom of movement. Yes, they have hemorrhaged talent. And that is a problem in modern Romania. Nearly 5 million have left. And what they've learned by traveling and working abroad is what real democracy should look and feel like. And they go home and their biggest protests were in 2018, partially led by the returning diaspora against the then PSD ruling party, who were wanting to encroach, you know, fiddle with judicial powers in order to prevent their leader going to prison. I'm happy to say those changes didn't happen. Liviu Dragnea is now in prison and there is a new liberal party in power for whom I have a degree of optimism. So it's interesting.
What's also interesting is that as Eastern European countries like Poland have taken a turn to the right, that has not been true in Romania. And here's an historian to comment on that. His name is Dragoș Pătrescu.
Ceausescu's flamboyant nationalism exhausted the power of nationalism as a political principle. Romanians are fed up with nationalism.
You know, nationalism is the kind of buzzword of where we're at the moment. And Romania's absolutely rejected that. There's a couple of reasons. One is he breaks with the Soviets, Ceausescu, and there's this kind of tub-thumping nationalism. And as I said, it didn't work. If you can't feed your people, if you're locking up their unwanted children in orphanages, they're not going to buy into that Romanian brand. Romanians have had enough of nationalism. It didn't work for them. And so they've not gone down that line.
Finally, Tessa, I think the image most Americans probably have of Romania is of the orphanages that were left behind by the communist regime. You have a pretty profound personal connection with that yourself. You volunteered at an orphanage in Siret in 1992. What was your experience like then and what's changed?
There was two reasons why there were so many orphanages. One was that, you know, you can't feed your population, you're on, and you don't give your population, you prohibit contraception of any sort, including abortions, you're going to have unwanted children. And also the communists wanted a perfect communist world. So disability was tucked away. It was, you know, incarcerated. And I worked in a children's psychiatric hospital. So there was a mixture of abandonment, but also mental and physical disability. The two girls that I remain in contact with, they were, I realize now, about 13, 14. I was 18, 19. So we're virtually the same age now. We're all over 40. You know, it's a profound relationship. They've never had a single visitor in their lives. They're still obviously have to have the support of, you know, an institution because they've never lived independently and they have learning difficulties. I also think they're a real sign that way in which their same community, they've never left Siret, now loves them and has integrated them and includes them compared with how excluded they were when I first met them. But more broadly, you know, when I go to Bucharest now, it reminds me a bit of Berlin 20, 15 years ago. It's kind of dark and cool and it's on the map. And I think we denigrate and we ignore these countries like Romania at our own peril. It's got the fastest growing economy in Europe. So, you know, watch out for it.
Tessa Dunlop is a journalist and historian. Her new BBC documentary is called Romania's Revolution 30 Years On. Thanks a lot, Tessa.
Thank you. Happy Christmas.
You're listening to The World. People in Kashmir have been living in the information dark ages without access to the web.
It's been August, September, October, November, December. It's like almost 4 months, which is still flabbergasting. It's still really unbelievable to me that we're having to go through this at this day and age.
India's internet clampdown, that's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Last night, seven presidential contenders faced off in California for the final Democratic debate of 2019. And one thing came up that really hadn't before.
I want to turn to another part of the world, and that's China.
Some of the Democratic candidates called for a more aggressive stance toward China. Here to make sense of what happened and the implications is Bonnie Glaser. She's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and has been a consultant to the State Department and the Pentagon on China.
Well, we've had many debates previously, and there's been very little discussion of foreign policy and not much of China. So I was pleased to see that there was a question about China, that a number of the candidates got an opportunity to emphasize the concerns.
What stood out for you among those comments about China?
Well, many of the candidates chose to emphasize Chinese repression. Several of the candidates expressed concern about China's use of technology and export of technology.
Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, he took a rather tough stand on China.
When folks out there standing up for democracy hear not a peep from the president of the United States, what message is that sending to the Chinese Communist Party? The message I will send is that if they perpetrate a repeat of anything like Tiananmen Square when it comes to Hong Kong, they will be isolated from the free world, and we will lead that isolation diplomatically and economically.
Is that really doable when you're president of the United States and dealing with China?
Well, it is doable to take a tough stance, to signal that the United States would respond very strongly if the Chinese were to use force to crack down on the protesters in Hong Kong. President Trump has not made a similar statement.
So, Bonnie, when you spoke about technology, that's something that Andrew Yang focused on.
I have family in Hong Kong. I spent 4 months there, and seeing what's happening on the streets, it's shocking. They banned face masks in Hong Kong. Why? Because they have AI technology that now is using facial recognition to identify protesters if they so much as do anything on the street.
I think that Andrew Yang is exactly right to focus on the use by China of facial technology to root out violent protesters in Hong Kong. He also mentioned that China is leapfrogging the United States in artificial intelligence, and that these advances are being subsidized by the Chinese government. And I think that these were very concrete points that demonstrates he really has an understanding of some of these challenges that China poses in the area of technology.
Now, Joe Biden, he actually referenced the Uyghurs in his comment.
What we have to make clear is that we, in fact, are not going to abide by what they've done. 1 million Uyghurs, as you pointed out, Muslims, are in concentration camps. That's what they are right now.
What could a U.S. president do about the Uyghurs?
I think that's the important question, and one that I think that Joe Biden actually struggled with in his response.
We should be moving 60% of our sea power to that area of the world to let, in fact, the Chinese understand that they're not going to go any further.
He also mentioned that the United States should have raised this at the United Nations, but there really can't be a military solution to this. And I think it really goes to the question of how difficult it is to convince China to change its policies domestically. There are no easy solutions because China is a rising power, and countries in the world want to have good relations with China, even as they are concerned about China's behavior, but they also want to cooperate with China. And indeed, some of the candidates talked about the need to cooperate with China. Mr. Steyer, for example, he emphasized, as he does, climate change.
If we are going to treat climate as the threat that it is, we are going to have to partner with the Chinese. They are going to have to come along with us. They're going to have to trust us. And together, we're going to have to solve this problem.
Now, what's interesting is, as you say, China's a tough country to deal with because it's so powerful. It's such an economic force. And Judy Woodruff kind of put a very plain and simple question.
Should the U.S., is my question, do more than protest and issue sanctions? Should the U.S., for example, boycott the 2022 Beijing Olympics?
What did you think of the answers to that?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, not a single candidate addressed that question. It's hard to say whether such a tough policy could really get support in the United States and around the world.
Bonnie Glaser is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and she's been a consultant on China for the State Department and Pentagon. Thanks a lot, Bonnie.
Thanks for having me.
138 days. That's how long people in Indian-controlled Kashmir have been without the internet. The Indian government brought the region offline in August. That makes this internet blackout the longest in a democracy, according to monitoring groups. And it's just one of many internet shutdowns the Indian government has imposed this year. Here's the world's Lydia Amanalidou.
Pervez Ahmad is kind of a local celebrity in Kashmir. A couple years ago, he and his friends started a YouTube channel. It's called Kashmiri Kalkarabs, which translates roughly to crazy genius Kashmiris. In these videos, Ahmad and his friends act out skits. The point is to talk about social issues relevant to Kashmiris and to make people laugh. The videos are low budget, nothing fancy, but they've gotten a big following, about 500,000 subscribers. Ahmad and his friends used to post videos pretty frequently, but their channel has been silent for months. Their last video was uploaded on August 4th. That was a day before the Indian government suddenly revoked Kashmir's autonomy and shut down all communications, not just the internet. Since then, authorities have restored some access to phone lines, which is why I was able to dial Ahmad on the phone. Hi, this is Lydia again. It took a while for me and Ahmad to get to talking about the impact the internet blackout has had on him because the line was just terrible. Hi, are you able to hear me now? 1, 2.
Hello?
Can you hear me? And remember, this is really the only way Kashmiris can connect with the outside world right now. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay, I will speak very loud. When we were finally able to hear each other, Ahmad told me that his earnings, his livelihood, it's all dependent on YouTube.
My earning, everything is dependent on this YouTube.
Before the shutdown, he and his friends were making about $2,000 to $3,000 a month through advertisements on their popular channel. But now, with no internet, they're not able to earn a single penny.
We are currently not able to earn a single penny.
He also said that being plunged into a pre-internet era has brought Kashmir to a standstill.
We are suffering from a lot. Everyone is affected.
We're suffering a lot, he says. Everyone is affected. Banks are not working properly, phones are not working properly, schools aren't functioning properly, and students aren't able to do any work. There are reports of pharmacies unable to restock medicines, people unable to get emergency medical services, businesses on the brink of collapse. This isn't the first time India's pulled the plug on the internet in Kashmir.
But the fact that it's been August, September, October, November, December, it's like 4 months, which is still flabbergasting. It's still really unbelievable to me that we're having to go through this at this day and age.
That's Sumaya Telly. She's a Kashmiri writer. She lives here in Boston, but has lots of friends and family back in Kashmir.
Every time I'm able to speak to anyone in my family, they say, oh, we feel like a prisoner. We feel caged.
She told me about a friend who runs an online business, someone she described as a leading entrepreneur in Kashmir.
I was concerned about a message her in September, and I received a message back from her almost 2 months later. And she said, my workers are gone. They don't work for me anymore. She was saying that as an online-based business, I'm unable to reach my customers. And she shared with me that she was unable to pay her rent.
The Indian government says that the internet shutdown in Kashmir is needed to keep peace and order in the region. It's given similar reasons for other blackouts it imposed in parts of India in the past couple weeks, parts of India where huge protests have erupted in response to a new citizenship law that's accused of discriminating against Muslims. The Indian government says that no internet means fewer rumors, less disinformation spreading online, and therefore less violence. But experts who track internet shutdowns say they're noticing a startling trend here.
What we are finding is this has become the new normal.
Prashant Sugatan is with an organization in New Delhi that tracks internet shutdowns in India. It's called SFLC.in. And he says that this year alone, the Indian government has ordered more than 90 internet shutdowns in the country.
When there is some unrest in some part of the country, this is the first thing that they do now, to shut down the internet. That definitely is a problem.
A problem because as internet use continues to grow in India, the government there has become the world leader in internet shutdowns. This year, internet blackouts in India accounted for more than 60% of shutdowns around the world, according to researchers. Critics say the government is doing this to prevent people from organizing, to keep news of dissent from spreading abroad. Pervez Ahmad, the Kashmiri YouTuber, says that in the process, the Indian government is denying people a human right because he says the internet is no longer a luxury.
As oxygen is needed to every human, internet is also needed.
As oxygen is needed for every human, internet is needed for every human, he told me. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
India's number one when it comes to internet shutdowns, but it's certainly not the only one that pulled the plug in 2019.
We've seen shutdowns in Venezuela, Iraq, Egypt, Russia, West Papua, Zimbabwe, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Mauritania, Monrovia.
And the list goes on. Next week, we look back on a record-breaking year for internet shutdowns. Who's doing them, why, and how?
So there's this classic legend of an internet kill switch. A president or leader sits in his office and he can just switch off the national internet. It turns out that that's not happening so much around the world.
That's next week on The World. People aren't always who they say they are. For all you know, that married couple next door with two kids might be Russian spies. I know, sounds like something from the plot of the TV show The Americans.
Super secret spies living next door, they look like us. They speak better English than we do. They're not allowed to say a single word in Russian once they get here.
That's because the show was inspired by the true story of Alexander Vavilov's parents. They were charged and arrested with espionage almost 10 years ago. The whole family was sent back to Russia. But Alexander Vavilov was a teenager. He wanted to stay in Canada, where he was born. Since then, he's been fighting for his birthright citizenship in Canada, and today, he won. Hadiyat Nizami is one of Alexander Vavilov's lawyers. What have these past 10 years been like for the Vavilov brothers?
What I've seen is actually been quite bad. They obviously do not belong to Russia, and they did not feel Russian. So they spent as much time as they possibly could to stay out of Russia. And of course, they could not return to Canada because Canada would not allow them.
What about their relationship with their parents? Are they in touch with them?
They were obviously not happy with their parents. I understand that there were even discussions about why did you have children and you shouldn't have had children. So now this happened in 2010. And since then, a lot has taken place. I am sure they're speaking with their parents, but obviously this has been difficult for them.
So Alexander and his brother Timothy, they say they never knew anything about their parents being spies.
That's what they say. That's exactly what they say. And in fact, all the evidence we have seen shows that that was correct.
So in 2010, when their parents' cover was blown and they were arrested, what happened to the kids?
The kids were at home. FBI raided their house and handcuffed their parents and obviously alleged that they were spies and led them away. This is where all the ordeal began for them, starting to ponder what was going on. And they had assumed, in fact, they had, Alexander explains that he thought it was a case of a mistaken identity, and they thought it would be cleared up in a few minutes, etc., a few hours. However, that did not turn out to be the case.
What did the court rule today? Why do Alexander and Timothy get to be granted citizens of Canada?
Because they were born in Canada. And as a result, they are Canadian citizens. Everyone born in Canada is a Canadian citizen. There is one narrow exception, and it only applies to children of foreign nationals who are in Canada in connection with diplomatic institutions and diplomatic relations and have immunities and privileges from Canadian laws.
I'm assuming not everyone is pleased that Vavilov has been granted Canadian citizenship. I mean, some experts argue that he's Russian and he should be the responsibility of the Russian government. What do you say to that?
Well, that's not the way the law works. I mean, the law in a society like Canada, in a democratic country, is that you do not punish children for sins of their parents. Everyone is equal under the law and is responsible for their own actions. The children have done nothing wrong. Had the children done something wrong, then you have law, we have laws to deal with them. But we do not use citizenship laws just because we don't like the parents of some children to punish the children for it.
Hadiat Nizami is the lawyer for Alexander Vavilov, the son of two former Russian spies. He won Canadian citizenship today. Hadiat, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many people call Trump a Teflon president. No scandal seems to stick to him. That perception isn't just held here in the U.S. In Nigeria, impeachment doesn't bother many of Trump's supporters. Just as they weren't put out when Trump referred to sub-Saharan nations as S-hole countries and reportedly described their leader, President Muhammadu Buhari, as lifeless. To find out why President Trump has so many fans and free passes in Nigeria, I reached out to writer and journalist Adobe Trisha Numbani. She's based in Abuja.
When you hear him being discussed, it's with admiration most of the time. People admire his tough guy image, his bluntness is entertaining, and really he's not very different from, he's weird to Americans, he's strange, he's different from what you've had. But we're used to leaders who speak without restraint, who are verbally abusive when they please, and so there's nothing, he's not as outlandish to us as he may appear to an American. We're a deeply religious country, and some of his policies are considered favorable to religious people.
I ask partly because Christianity Today, which is a leading evangelical magazine, it was launched by televangelist Billy Graham. There was an editorial in yesterday calling President Trump morally lost and confused and arguing that he should be removed from office. Has Trump's behavior raised eyebrows with Nigerian evangelicals?
Well, the important thing to remember is that Christians in Nigeria, and I would imagine around the world, don't necessarily support Trump, President Trump, because he's a good person. They feel he's an instrument being used by God. Now, people make references to people in the Bible like Nebuchadnezzar, Pharaoh, who were instruments in, who were used of God to do different things or elevate God's people and all sorts of things to push what they felt was God's agenda, even when they were not necessarily good men. So people tend to agree he's not the nicest person, he's not the most righteous human being or anything, but they believe that he's an instrument in God's hands to push God's agenda in this time. Obama, for example, President Obama, amongst Nigerian Christians, wasn't particularly popular. I've heard people refer to him as the Antichrist because of his policies. Never mind that he had, at least on the surface, he appears to be a good man.
What is it about what Trump is doing that is God's agenda, according to that view?
They obviously, the things on abortion and gay rights. And
so social conservative views.
Yes. So I've listened to people go into end time eschatology about the end times and things that prophecies about the things that will happen in the end times. And they feel that the things Trump is doing beyond things like abortion and gay rights, beyond those ones, in terms of bringing about the event that will, according to prophecies in the religious books, that he seems to be the person that is putting things in place and pushing things, preparing the stage for the things, the prophecies that have been, you know, the predictions for the end time. So I've heard those deep conversations, people feeling that Trump is an instrument in arranging world affairs so that the stage is set for the prophecies and predictions for the end time.
What about this? Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari, he was the first leader of a sub-Saharan country to visit Trump in the White House. That was in April 2018. And afterward, Trump reportedly described him as lifeless. Was there any blowback after that comment?
The opposition used it as a weapon. We had our general elections in February, and we have more than 70 candidates who wanted to get President Buhari out of that seat. And all of them used that lifeless comment. They used it to describe his performance in the economy, used it to describe his health issues, which have been well publicized. He spent a number of months in hospital abroad. So people use that lifelessness comment to describe, anyway, the government of President Buhari. But of course, it didn't work. He's back in power. Again, remember that the majority of his supporters are people in the rural areas of certain parts of Nigeria who don't have access to the social media and who don't know what Trump thinks or says about President Buhari. So he still won, came, but was returned to power.
What about the impeachment news in the U.S. this week, the House impeaching President Trump? Has that appeared in Nigerian headlines this week?
Well, it has been in the headlines because, of course, everybody follows the news in America. And again, it hasn't necessarily dented his support here because people are convinced that it is his enemies at work. We live in a part of the world where once you hear the word impeachment, it's obviously an attack by one's political opponent. So it's entertaining for Nigerians, but I don't think it will necessarily dent his image in this part of the world. And that's the way it's being viewed, that his enemies are against him. And then this is they're throwing what they believe is their best weapon.
So when somebody like me reads that the results of the Pew poll and it says, oh, Nigerians really like Trump, are we kind of fundamentally misreading what this is really about? Because you keep saying it's all about internal politics in Nigeria. It's not really about Trump. So do Nigerians like Trump or not?
My understanding is they do. But remember that they're not reading every single thing. They're not following every single thing he's doing, the general things that come out. We sit down and we laugh. Oh, look at what he said. Look at what he's done. So the impression you get when you sit down casually with people is that they do like him. People like his tough guy image. People are impressed by how he consistently rises above his challenges, defeats his enemies. You know, that it's impressive. That's the impression I get from when you're listening to people talking about him here. Remember, there are millions of people in Nigeria, over 200 million people, more than 200 million.
Most populous country in Africa.
Exactly. There are actually people to whom none of this matters. But to the Nigerians who are aware of what's going on in the world, Trump appears to be popular. They find him amusing more than anything else, more amusing than disgusting. And that's really the way it is.
Nigerian writer and journalist Adobe Trisha Nwambani is based in Abuja. Her latest novel is Buried Beneath the Baobab Tree. Thanks a lot, Adobe.
Thank you, Carol.
Before we head off into the weekend, my colleague Marco Werman dropped his list of some of his favorite albums released in 2019. It's an eclectic list he shares each year with our show director, April Peavy. You want some retro soul from a Finnish record label? Or maybe some Latin pop? Perhaps some rhythms from a famous Mexican actress? We've got the list at theworld.org. We'll leave you today with one of Marco's picks. The style is called Ghanaian High Life. And nobody does it better than Pat Thomas and Kwashibu Area Band. Their 2019 album is called Obia. Pat Thomas and Kwashibu Area Band. We'll share more of our favorite music from 2019 next week. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a groovy weekend. We're back on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.